Welcome to the Automotive Diagnostic Podcast. We're going to explore ways to sharpen our diagnostic skills, find learning resources, and hear from experts in the automotive field. This podcast is brought to you by Jarhead Diagnostics. Jarhead Diagnostics manufactures in-house diagnostic equipment and storage solutions, as well as distributes for companies like Pico, ATS, and Topdon. One of my favorite tools that I have bought from Brandon and Jarhead Diag is the case for the U-scope. If you don't have a U-scope, you probably should, but if you have one, you got to get one of these 3D printed cases, has a magnet on it, has a full-size BNC lead that you can connect to, and it gets rid of the weak point of that scope, which is the mini BNC connection, which is pretty fragile. This case makes this thing nice and secure and makes it an even better tool than it was. So check out jarheaddiag.com. The link is in the show notes. Hey, what's going on, automotive world? Welcome to another episode of the Automotive Diagnostic Podcast. My name is Sean Tipping. Thank you so much for joining me. Today on the show, I've got Mike McLaughlin joining me. Mike is a technician out in Seattle, and he does something a little bit different. He installs and services and diagnoses propane systems. So these are add-on customizations to gas or diesel vehicles that allows them to run on propane when selected by the driver. And we'll talk all about it, but it actually switches from its primary fuel source, gas or diesel, to running just on propane. Now, this is a topic I really didn't know much about, so I've got a ton of questions about it. I have very little experience in the alternative fuel world, but there is a whole world to it. So this is a really interesting conversation. It's great to meet Mike, and just interesting to hear about another side of the automotive industry that you might not think of all the time. So with that out of the way, let's jump in. Well, good evening, Mike. What's happening?
Not too much, Sean. Like I said, I appreciate you having me on the show and being able to reach out to you and hopefully talk about alternative fuels.
Yeah. That's a topic I don't know very much about. So I'll have plenty of questions. Why don't we start off with number one, where you're at, and then what you're doing in the automotive world and how you got there.
Okay. So I'm based out of Seattle, Washington. I started in a shop back home, which was Southern Oregon, and I had a good buddy up here that I'd reached out to me about joining a propane company, actually, to support their auto gas program. So it's 6 months ago or so I moved up here, and we've basically built the program from the ground up, supporting fleets, and we'll take vehicles and put conversion kits on them, gas or diesel, primarily gas with the fleets we work with, and we'll get them set up on running on propane.
Okay. How many Hank Hill jokes have you heard so far?
A lot.
Because you do work with propane accessories, right?
I do. Propane and propane accessories. Okay. That is true.
Right. I had to get that out of the way. So, So running on propane, is this something where they're solely running on propane? Is it a two fuel situation? How does that work?
So you can. There's different setups. There's a dedicated or monofuel is what we call it.
Okay.
Which is where you'll solely run on propane itself. There is bi-fuel setups where we actually leave the OE system in place and we can switch between gasoline and propane seamlessly.
Okay.
And when you start moving into the diesel territory, we can do what they call a dual fuel, which is where we actually supplement out diesel and add in propane.
Really?
Yeah.
So in a diesel engine, you can run it on propane?
Yeah, it's actually a power adder for diesel.
Okay.
So there is some calibration work that goes in there that I personally don't deal with that. That's above me. But we'll supplement. The numbers are almost 40%. We can almost offset 40% of diesel with propane, depending on engine load conditions.
Wow, that's crazy. So this is actually all of my experience with like propane in relation to running an engine. When I taught at the college, we had a course. I taught the like engine mechanical course, and part of that, part of the ASE requirements to be accredited as a program is the students had to go through an engine build. Essentially, they could do a bunch of small tasks on various engines and still meet the requirements, but the best way to do it is a full tear down and rebuild of an engine. And so we had motors set up on stands so that they could do this. And they were all the same motor, so that when I have six groups of students with engines apart, it's tough enough to keep track of all of that to make sure that it ends up the right way. But then at least they're the same engine that it's all happening. But anyways, once they're all back together on the stand, they were old GM 2.2 pushrod motors. Real simple, basic, great for a build. But then we could run them off of propane. So we just had a 20-pound or 30-pound propane tank there, and then a regulator that bolted onto the throttle and turned on the propane. And they'd run fantastic on the propane. They ran great. You could rev them up and all that stuff. And that was the fun part, is like you actually got to, as a student, you got to see your engine run after you built it, and hopefully there's no rod knocks or oil leaks or anything like that. That goes against your grade, obviously, but that was pretty much my experience. So like I knew I could run an engine off of it, but never any experience in the field. I've seen a couple vehicles. I think Chevy trucks are the only ones where they've been converted back, like they were a CNG style. And then they've been converted back to gasoline. So like they still had some of the components, but most of it had been removed. But I've never actually even worked on one that was a dual fuel or an alternative fuel vehicle. So you've seen plenty of this though. And so in Seattle, like how cold does it get there? And does that play a role in this?
Actually propane prefers the cold.
Okay.
You're not going to like, if you look at diesel, you won't get gelling as a problem. Mm. Propane actually boils at negative 44 degrees.
Okay.
The temps down here, I think I've seen it low 20s.
Okay.
It rains a lot.
Yeah.
Most of the time.
But
weather's not bad. I like the cooler weather personally.
Yeah. I like the spring and the fall for sure. The middle of winter I'd probably do without, but, yeah, that was actually one of the curiosities that I had is if temperature played a role in that, in the real cold starting weather. So when we're talking about propane, obviously we're, And maybe you can structure this better for the listeners, because like I said, I don't know nothing about it. But what kind of pressure are we talking about in the fuel storage? And what does the fuel storage look like on one of these things?
So pressure is dependent on temperature.
Okay.
With propane. So colder temperatures will actually be at a lower pressure, and at higher temperatures will go to a higher pressure. But you're not looking at anything over 315 PSI.
Okay.
That's our max pressure that we'll run. And as far as tanks, you know, CNG, you'll see a lot of composite tanks, which would be like a type four. There's four different types of tanks. Propane, we're using all steel.
Okay.
So you have a steel tank, and we can mount them inside the car with a vapor box, of course, if they're going inside, or we could do exterior if you have room in the frame rail. I've done them in the back of
what's a vapor box
beds on. It's just shielding. So in the event of any vapor leaking out,
uh-huh.
We don't want it to enter the cab of the vehicle for safety reasons.
Okay.
So that vapor box will go over any of the fittings we have on the inside and vent to the outside atmosphere.
Okay. The what is the difference between like the CNG, the compressed natural gas, and propane? Is it just energy content, or is there another differences between them?
I mean, different chemical makeup. The energy difference is there. So even what gasoline's like 122,000 or 123,000 BTU.
Uh-huh.
Propane's 91,400.
Okay.
And CNG is even less than propane. So I think we're coming in somewhere around 80,000 with CNG.
Okay. So you got to add quite a bit more to get the same output out of the engine.
A little bit. Yeah. There's not going to be a power loss. Just with the way we are on BTUs, you'll have to add a little bit more propane to make that same power. So you're just going to burn a little bit more fuel.
Okay. How do they, and I guess, do they like measure fuel economy with a gas, like whether it be compressed natural gas or propane? Like, what is it per, you know, you do miles per gallon for gas. What do you do for propane?
That's a really good question. I'm trying to think how I would answer that.
Or maybe it's like, how does it compare to the usage of gasoline to get your car 50 miles down the road?
So I guess the way I can answer that is we would calculate as efficiency.
Okay.
So when we run propane, there's that misconception that we're going to have less power, and that's not the case. We just have lower BTU content. So as far as efficiency to gasoline, we're about a 10% loss.
Okay.
Compared to gasoline, but so you'll burn a little more fuel, but we're a cleaner fuel at the same time.
Gotcha. So the emissions out of the tailpipe are a little bit better.
Yeah. Depending on the vehicle, I think they calculate it as an average is about 20% reduction in total greenhouse gases.
Huh.
But if we, I know, are you still using your Ford Transit for your
yes,
mobile stuff?
Yes, sir. I bought 305,000 at the moment. So
okay. I know. Is that running the 3.5 Duratec in that one?
No, I've got the Connect. So it's the 2.0 fixed cam gutless pig, but man, she keeps on going.
Okay. I know if we look at like the 3.6 and the ProMasters and the 3.5 Duratec, we could do, it's about 60% reduction in NOx. So emissions varies platform to platform.
Mm-hmm.
If I start looking at Ford's new 7.3 Godzilla that they have, that's about 34% reduction in NOx.
Wow.
Yeah.
What is stopping that from catching on? What's the barrier?
So that's the thing, is autogas isn't new. This has been around for a long time. I think us in the States were just behind the curve a little bit.
Okay.
I know it's really popular in places like Canada, Australia. You look at South America, there's a lot more propane systems. I think worldwide we're about 27 million vehicles running on propane.
Okay. I mean, they have to have separate fill-up stations for this, right? I don't even know what that looks like. What are you connecting? How does it work to fill up a tank?
So it's going to look almost identical to a gasoline dispenser or a diesel dispenser.
Okay.
And there's two types of fittings. We're actually, there was a rule change recently. So the new one's a quick connect. It used to be an old screw-on type fitting like you would see on forecliff cylinders.
Mm-hmm.
Now we're going to, I call them a Eurofill connector. It's just a quick connect coupling. So you push it on, you'll hear it click, it'll lock on there. You pull the lever and it'll start filling with propane.
Okay. And then for the fuel delivery system for the actual engine, how does that work? Where does it get fed into? Is it a single like insertion in the manifold? Do they have separate? I mean, would it be an injector? Like, how do they do that?
Yeah, you're kind of right on the money. Is depending on the system, there's different kits, which I work with a particular one, Prins, which is developed in the Netherlands.
Okay.
And there's distributors for them all over the world. You could look at stuff like Roush and Icom too. But yeah, we have injectors where you'll either drill an intake manifold. You can put a spacer in. We've had kits there where you'll replace the injector cups. So you'll basically put in a CNC'd aluminum cup where the factory injector would be. Then the factory injectors sit on that cup and will plumb in a vapor line.
Okay.
There's also a difference between vapor and liquid systems.
Mm.
So vapor, we're going to run injectors or use one of those cups or an intake spacer or drill an intake manifold. We try to be as least invasive as possible.
Mm-hmm.
And then you look into a liquid setup where it actually act like more like a modern day DI setup where we'll try to have another set of injectors or get those as close to the combustion chamber as we can.
So with a liquid system, does that involve like a fuel pump in a tank to move it, or how does that work?
Correct. Yeah. It'd just be a mechanical fuel pump.
Okay.
In the propane tank itself.
Now, is that a separate filling procedure for something like that? Or I imagine is it like temperature pressure that allows it, or when does it transition to a liquid? Sorry, I'm throwing a bunch of questions at you.
No, you're fine. So like I said, it's in a liquid state while it's under pressure, because propane sure. wants to boil at, I said negative 44 degrees.
Okay.
So while it's under pressure, it'll be liquidized. And then once we relieve it from pressure, that's when it's going to want to vaporize.
I gotcha.
Right.
So a lot like an AC system. And I actually, funny enough, I was talking to a guy the other day at a shop who was saying that people were filling their refrigerant systems with propane and it cooled fantastically. but yeah. I don't think you should do that. I don't think that's a great idea.
There are AC systems that run propane as a refrigerant.
Okay. Is that residential stuff or?
Yeah, there's a whole market to propane. So on top of being a technician and coming into this role, I've also had to start learning the propane industry.
Okay.
Which has been a whole nother song and dance in itself.
Huh. Yeah, it's crazy how many different worlds there are out there, and then once you get into something, you're like, I didn't realize this was an entire industry, entire group of people and professionals it's wild how much stuff is out there. So you're doing these conversions on vehicles. What vehicles are you doing them to? Like, is this fleet vehicles or these like individuals' vehicles that are bringing them to you, or who's your main customer base for stuff like this?
Right now, it's predominantly fleets.
Okay.
Is who we'll deal with. Our company's not opposed to working with individuals. If we have a kit and you contact us and you want to pay to have us install it, we'll do it.
Mm-hmm.
Mostly fleets. So I think the biggest one we have is 400 vehicles they have on propane.
Oh, okay. I mean, what's the sell to a fleet? What would be the advantage of doing that?
So the big one is fuel saving. So I don't know what gas prices are looking like where you're at in Minnesota.
Like three something right now.
Okay. Up here in Seattle, we're moving into spring and summer, so we're edging up on $5 a gallon.
Okay.
And the big thing is, autogas has a different pricing structure than if you were to fill, you know, a standard barbecue bottle or something like that. So if I guess for easy math, we'll just say it's the fuel savings at $5 a gallon up here, you're getting autogas at $2 a gallon.
Mm-hmm.
And so the fuel savings, $3 a gallon roughly. And then you're only losing that 10% efficiency while you're running on propane. Depending on your fleet size and fuel usage, you could get your return on investment in under a year.
Okay.
By installing those kits. Yeah.
Gotcha.
And a lot of part of just going green lately and moving forward, hybrids, EVs, people are more conscientious in their fleets too, is the emissions part of it as well.
Yeah, sure. Well, and is this considered a renewable resource? I don't even know, where do you get propane from?
Yeah, so propane is mostly out of natural gas and crude oil refining.
Okay.
About And it's all domestically made. I mean, the U.S. makes more propane than we can use. It's one of the U.S.'s largest exports.
Interesting.
Yeah. There is renewable propane, which we can do. If a fleet wants to be even more conscientious about it, they can request renewable propane from us, which is a whole different process on how that's made.
Okay.
If they request it, we just have to know ahead of time so we can have it stored and ready for them.
Gotcha. What about the software for the computer and the control system for this? Because you're putting this onto vehicles that were set up to run on gasoline originally, correct?
Correct, yes.
And so the computer's strategy and software and monitoring systems are all going to have to be adjusted. And then there's going to have to be some type of control, like regulation device to feed the correct amount of propane in, right?
This is true. So, and this goes back, there's so many different kits and manufacturers of kits where there can be a lot of variety here. I know there's certain manufacturers where on Chevys and Fords, they'll actually use the E85 map and use that map for their calibration.
Really? Okay.
Yeah.
Because that's got a lower energy content than gasoline too. So you'd be upping the delivery of fuel for E85.
Yeah. Our kit specifically, we have, they call it an AFC, alternative fuel controller, but it's just a natural module with our calibration on it.
Okay.
That runs that. And our kits are also all EPA and CARB tested as well.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So we're meeting all those requirements. And then part of that too is the user, the driver of the vehicle doesn't have any control to change that calibration.
Mm.
So that all gets set up. They run them on dynos and get everything fine-tuned, and we'll even get revisions, just like you would in the OE world, where if we need to tweak something or we see a problem, we'll make a revision to that calibration, and I'll go out in the field and update all those vehicles.
Okay, so then you're updating the standalone control module. What about like the vehicle's original PCM? How does that software work?
It actually has no idea that it's running on propane at all.
Really?
So we tap into the CAN network so we can monitor everything on the OE side.
Okay.
And that AFC just kind of acts as an intercept. We can read all of that OE data and even build in safety. So if there's a critical fault, engine's overheating, something like that, we can shut the propane system down.
Okay.
And it automatically kick back to running on, we say petrol. Just because when we're talking about propane, when we say gas,
we're that could get confusing propane. Easily. Okay. So, and I don't know how far into this that you get, but are they controlling? So you've got to do something to affect the stock PCM's fuel delivery, I would imagine. Like it's going to be pulling fuel back in order for you to add propane. How does that work? Is it on the monitoring side? Like, are you affecting the O2 sensor readings or?
We do look at O2s and we want to stay as close to everything as the OE wants. So we'll still be close to stoic. It depends on our harnesses too. Some of them run injector interrupts. So we'll read that factory injector timing and our AFC will see that.
Uh-huh.
And then, so at the push of a button, you know, you'll transition and run on propane. We'll be intercepting the stock injectors and see when they're going to fire. And that's how we base our propane injectors to fire.
Does it actually change the firing of the stock injectors at that point then? Like, does that deliver less petrol to the engine at that point?
It actually shuts it off.
Oh, it shuts it off completely. It'll stop. Oh.
Yep. Because we'll intercept it and we'll stop firing the petrol injectors.
Oh, okay.
And we'll just fire the gas or the propane injectors at that point.
So it's not a situation where it's actually getting both at the same time. It's one or the other.
Correct, yeah.
Okay.
And there's parameters that need to be made, you know, and unless you're on a mono setup, you're not going to start on propane. It's like you were saying in school how you had the regulators. Mm-hmm. If we actually need to heat that regulator in the car, because we'll have one in there unless you're running a liquid system. So ours are vapor based.
Uh-huh.
So we'll actually take that regulator and we'll pipe coolant into it so it doesn't freeze over. Because as that propane vaporizes, it's gonna ice up because it's so cold.
Sure. That's really interesting.
It's been an interesting 6 months of learning, and I'm still in the process. I'm a licensed installer for them. At basically they rate it in tiers.
Uh-huh.
So I'm entrusted to make decisions or modifications if needed. Obviously not engineering ones, but if I see an issue with a kit or I need to field test something for them, I can do that.
What did you do before that in the field that got you there? They got you to this point.
So I started back home at a mom and pop shop. It was a pretty well-known shop in town that had been around for a long time. And I just got tired of my IT job. I realized I didn't like sitting at a desk. I had a acquaintance that worked there, and I just started poking him about getting a job because I've always liked working on cars and figuring how things worked, and got my foot in the door. Started doing oil changes and brakes, and very quickly they realized that I was capable. And I think 3 months in, they had me pulling motors and
okay.
tearing stuff down and, nice. And doing bigger jobs. Just
throw you in the deep end right away.
Oh, yeah. I became the Subaru guy back home very fast. A lot of Subarus.
Okay. All right. Well, there's plenty of broken Subarus too, so you do all right there. Head gaskets for days.
That was a lot of the work I had to do. Yeah. EJ20s, EJ25s.
So the conversion process for a vehicle, what's all involved? Like, what's the time frame to do that to a vehicle?
So it varies kit to kit. Obviously some platforms are going to be easier than others. Just me as one guy, if I have some stuff prepped, I can get it done in a couple days. And it's not that it's hard or really complicated or labor intensive. It's just some of the work is tedious when you're installing those kits.
Okay.
Obviously you want to keep safety in mind when we're dealing with other people's fleets and drivers and, just cleanliness as well. When you install the kit, you want to make sure I try to think about someone else that's going to maintenance it down the road. If it's going to be me or that fleet's mechanic or whoever.
Sure.
I want to try to keep our stuff out of the way and it as simple as possible to
okay.
to maintenance filters and solenoids that are on those systems.
What is the storage tank for the propane? Like, is it a cylinder or depending on the vehicle? Where does that go and how much space does it occupy?
Yeah. So if we take a passenger car, like a regular sedan, we can use the spare tire well. So if you don't mind not having a spare tire or you want to just keep it in the trunk, we have toroidal tanks that fit there, and they vary in size. I think one of our smaller ones is 16 or 18 usable gallons.
Okay.
Because with propane, you have to have not only liquid space, but vapor space in that tank.
Oh.
As it boils off in the tank, you have to have room for that vapor. So you're at about 80% capacity of that tank's water capacity. So however much water it could fit, you're at 80% of that. So if we have a 10-gallon tank, we can only fill to 8 gallons.
Okay. How's that regulated when the driver of the vehicle is filling these things up, or is there a technician at the fill station?
So they actually have a float inside that will shut the pump off.
Oh.
When that float reaches that level, it'll close the valve and it just won't let any more
okay.
propane in. I mean, there are, you know, when we talk bobtails and stuff like that, you can obviously fill them past 80 because you're depending on the driver or the technician to shut that pump off at that point.
Okay.
But when it comes to auto gas, it will stop at that 80% mark.
Gotcha. And what's the reflection to the driver of the level of propane? Is it just another gauge that's on there, or is it a pressure gauge? How do they know if it's full or empty?
So we have two gauges, one actually on the tank, which is just a potentiometer, which feeds into a digital gauge on the dash.
Okay.
Where you'll actually get, you know, 5 or 6 bars that'll tell you full, and then it'll chunk out bars as you go to empty.
Okay.
It actually beep at you too when you, it flags the tank is completely empty, and it'll beep and then let you know that it's switching back to petrol at that point.
Okay. So it'll automatically switch over if it realizes, hey, we're out of propane here.
Yeah, I can, in the, when I set them up, I could set it up so it has a save memory state. So if you're running it on propane and you shut the vehicle off and you go to start your car the next morning or truck, it will remember that we were running on propane. It'll complete its startup cycle where it wants to see, you know, engine RPM, minimum runtime, engine temperature. Once it meets those requirements, it'll just kick right back onto propane.
Okay.
And you could change that at the push of a button. If you don't want to have it run on propane, you just hit the button, it'll beep, switches right back to petrol.
Nice. You mentioned like the service of the vehicle once they're out in the field. Is this something where they have to, or they would want to bring it somewhere where someone's qualified and understands this sort of thing? Or how does that work as far as the maintenance and repair and diagnostics of the vehicle go, right? Like if I got one in my bay tomorrow, I'd be calling Mike, be like, dude, how do I?
So, you're still, the way our engineers taught me is you're still going to diagnose it as a normal vehicle.
Okay. Right?
As far as the OE system, diagnostics don't change. As far as the propane system, you do need some proprietary software and a cable, which is less than a generic scan tool like an Autel or Launch. You're maybe $500 and you can get a diagnostic kit sent to you and the login for the software.
Okay.
There is different levels inside that software. So if we have a fleet, they can bring it to me if they want. If they want me to go to their fleet and train their technicians, we are more than willing to do that. If they want me to go and teach a class on basic service and how to use the software and diagnose the propane side, we are more than willing to do that and support the fleets that we serve.
Okay. So and imagine a lot of the time it would just be determining like, hey, is this just a normal engine fault? Like, or is it something to do with the propane system? And then, okay, now we've got to switch over to that style of diagnostics with the scan tool you mentioned.
I have gotten a lot of cases where propane is new to people. So I think it's maybe a little scary to them.
Sure.
And they automatically want to blame the propane system.
Yeah. Yeah.
I deal with that a lot.
Right.
I remember one particular call I got recently. I had to drive, it's like 2 hours south. It was on a Chevy 2500. I think it had a 5.3 mm-hmm. or 6. I don't remember. And he said that it would shudder at about 70 miles an hour when it was running on propane. So the first question I always ask if I'm going to come down is, can you run it on gasoline and duplicate the issue?
Sure.
And he swore to me up and down that he did, but I can see in the software the hours on petrol versus gas. So I could tell which fuel you're running on predominantly.
Okay.
And I end up making multiple trips down there trying to figure this out. I was on the phone with engineers, looking at calibration files, documenting things. And it finally came down to a TSB that I found that absolutely fit the bill of it, everything he was describing. So on that particular GM, it was, I don't have the TSB number on me, but it was condensation that was getting into the torque converter, causing a shudder.
Okay.
And so I even got, I don't have relationships with dealers up here yet, but working back home, I called our local GM dealer, got on the phone. And I said, hey, is this a known problem? And I gave him the TSB and he said, I don't care if that thing's running propane. This is a known issue.
Yeah. Yeah.
They need to bring it in.
Uh-huh. Yeah, a 6-speed Chevy truck with a torque converter problem, that never happens. We are proud to have Automotive Seminars as a sponsor for this show. Hey, you've heard me talking about this. You heard the ads that I've had on here for Automotive Seminars. I want to let everybody know that they are about to get going with their training schedule for 2024. They've got 7 classes this year, and one of them is going to be starting this week on the 6th, and that is going to be taught by Keith Perkins. It's a diagnosing keys and immobilizer systems. And they've got courses throughout the year, total of 7 of them. And right now, if you get in on it before February 6th, you can get a discount and basically get a free class if you sign up for the package. So I wanted to let everybody know to check this out. Again, Keith Perkins, John Thornton, Scott Manna, classes like Picoscope 7, Lin Bus Diagnostics, Misfire Diagnostics, Variable Cam Timing, really, really good stuff to help us out in the field. And I can't say enough good things about it. So get on there, check it out, get the discount, and get some awesome training from these guys. It's the same thing in my world where I'm doing the programming and the software on lots of different vehicles for many different reasons. And a lot of the time, the shop owners or the technicians I'm working with are very quick to blame the software for whatever problem they're having, because like you mentioned, it's just something that they don't fully understand exactly what it is or isn't, or how it works, or what changes, you know, or how you do it. And so like, yep, it's gotta be a software problem, you know, and they just stop all other pursuit of the problem or looking at things you normally would. It's just like, well, that's a mysterious thing that's connected to the thing that I'm working on. That must be the problem. So I feel you there for sure. I've been dealing with that with a few shops recently where I'm just like, dude, putting a solenoid strategy into a Ford does not prevent it from going into forward or reverse gear. Like, it doesn't work that way. the dude, he called me up. He's like, your dude, you know, he programmed the solenoid strategy and now it doesn't go into gear. I'm like, that's not us, man. I'm sorry. That's not how that works.
All right. And that's what I was telling this guy too. He kind of looked at me like I didn't know what I was talking about. And I said, there's nothing in our kit where we mess with or tap into the transmission at all.
Right.
As far as this truck knows, it doesn't even know it's running on propane.
Mm-hmm. Which is really interesting to think about that. It's fooled the engine control strategy to not even know.
As no clue. Mm. It's the craziest thing.
Yeah. No, really interesting. You know, somebody figured all that out. What kind of problems do you see with these systems? What diagnostics or problems have you run into?
It's pretty standard stuff. Either wires getting damaged. Coolant issues when we're heating the reducers on a vapor setup. If you're not taking care of the cooling system, obviously we're tied into it, so that can get gummed up.
Okay.
I've seen. Most of the time I've seen people neglect filter changes for way over recommended mileage and start doing some crazy things with pressures and, or drivability. Most of it's pretty basic. So filters, wiring, you know, cooling system, there's not a lot of crazy things
okay.
that I've had happen or experienced yet. But the guy that taught me that came out from Alliance Auto Gas was a great guy, and he's seen some stuff where we've actually had to dive into the nitty gritty and start making log files on some of these propane systems to flag some issues.
Okay.
And that's generally where updated calibration comes into play.
Gotcha. Yeah, I suppose we're making custom software for vehicles. There's going to be, you know, weird situations, and then, yeah, understanding how it plays into all the other normal issues that a vehicle might have would be just a ton of work. So you guys do updates to these systems pretty regularly then?
Yeah, we'll do tech talks once a month where we actually get to sit in with the engineer that designed these systems.
Okay.
And we'll get to go talk about different topics, or if we want to suggest our own topic and all of us are having a problem with something, we'll say, hey, can we discuss this in further detail? And next month we'll get together and he'll have a whole 30-minute, hour-long presentation ready for us.
That's cool.
Which I actually, I got to go to ATE, one of my first big training events, and I talked to Hawk and Light, and he was pretty jealous that I had an engineer on standby to
yeah,
talk to.
Yeah, that would be absolutely fantastic. I almost never have that opportunity to reach out and be like, hey, what's going on here? How did you make this happen? I don't understand.
Yeah, I try not to abuse that power for the most part.
Yeah,
but
right. Yeah, that would be really cool. Sometimes you get in there with these computer systems and you're just like, I don't know what it's trying to do or what it's seeing here that it does or doesn't like and how it's reacting to this problem. I had a 5-volt reference problem on a Honda the other day. It's like a 2020. And it was really strange because once there was a problem on the 5-volt reference for longer than a second, it turned it off. And I hadn't run into that before. Like usually as soon as the problem for the 5-volt reference is gone, like let's say a sensor shorts it to ground, like once that problem is removed, the 5-volt reference just comes back. In my experience, that's been like every control module ever. You fix the problem, it's back like that. Not the case on this Honda. You have to do a key cycle or clear the codes in order for the 5-volt reference to come back. Well, I didn't realize that. And so I thought the fault was still present. And so I'm unplugging stuff and looking across the circuit. I'm like, why can't I get this reference to come back? And it needed a key cycle. And then it popped it back. And so it really, really set me, you know, down a wild goose chase. But that's like engineer level, right? That's somebody designed that system to operate that way. But I had no idea. So it would have been great to call. If you're that Honda engineer and you're listening to the show, give me a ring. I'd love to talk.
We have ran into some of that on the propane systems where since we're tied into the CAN network, some of the fleets run, you know, drive cams, I mean, GPS monitoring, a lot of different stuff on that CAN network. And we've actually run into some problems where we've had to modify our system so we're not constantly monitoring CAN, where in order to look at the propane side, sometimes we have to key cycle. Because I can read, obviously, all the OE stuff through our software as well.
Yeah.
And look at live data and clear codes and monitor everything. But
yeah, that is something to consider, is as so many different things get added onto that bus that weren't factory. It's very possible to cause traffic or issues there. So yours, are you saying your software that you're using plugs directly to the OBD2 port, or is there a separate connector for that?
So we can do a jumper harness that would plug into the OBD port and feed back into our kit.
Okay.
I can also basically, like a lot of the ones I've been doing are Fords lately, so I'll go into the back of that gateway and I'll D-pin 19 and 20.
Okay.
Which is their CAN high and low, and I'll just T-tap into them.
Gotcha.
So I'll, you know, take some sheathing off, solder it in, make it look clean and nice, and directly feed it. There's only been a handful of instances where we've had so much stuff on the network where we've had to change calibration, where on startup, it'd just run a health check of the vehicle real quick, and then we'll pass CAN back to the vehicle and everything that they're running.
Okay. Obviously, there's no other way, or there's probably not an easier way to get the information that you need about what's happening on the vehicle, because it's all right there on that CAN network. And if you can decipher that, and that's like you say, that's a lot of engineering that goes into that to figure all that stuff out.
Yeah. Our engineer is a really, really smart guy. I really like our tech talks, and I think this summer I'll actually get to go out to their facility in Tennessee and spend some time with them, which I'm looking forward to doing.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, where do you see yourself going in the company? Is there opportunities to move up, or what does that look like?
So right now, we're based in 5 different states, and we operate in autogas in 4 because California has their own EPA standard.
Sure.
So it cost Prins, the company, drastically more to do the EPA cert just for California.
Mm.
So we're kind of just holding off on that right now. But I'm the sole tech for 4 states.
Oh, really? Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. So you're busy.
Yeah, I'm booked out for the next 3 months right now.
Holy shit. Okay.
Between conversions, service, trainings. So it's all go, no stop.
Wow. Well, that's great that there's that much work for you. Is it a situation where somebody needs their vehicle fixed and they have to wait that long, or how does that work if something's broke down?
So, like I said, a lot of these fleets have their own mechanics that we've trained or technicians that we've trained.
Okay.
I like to consider us all techs now. We're not just mechanics anymore.
Sure.
But they'll call me up, and if they don't understand something, I'll field the call in the middle of a conversion and help them out. Or if they need parts, they're generally close by, so they can run over, or I'll stop what I'm doing and go drop off parts or help them diagnose something.
For like wiring diagrams, how does that work? They have access to some sort of information base, or?
So they don't, but I do. So if they need something, I can get it on the fly.
Okay.
Within minutes. Yeah. I think one that we were fielding is some fleets, their policy is to have a full tank at all times. And on the newer vehicles, that was an issue we ran into where we were actually setting a code because the tank gauge wouldn't move.
Oh, so it expects to see some movement at some point.
Correct. So our engineer actually came up with a brilliant idea on how to do that, which basically uses a relay and some resistors, and we kind of trick the OE system into thinking the gauge has moved every time it looks at it.
Sure. It's like the mouse jiggler for your Zoom meetings or whatever. Okay. How about like performance of the vehicle? Is there any change in that aspect? Can you get any performance boost out of something like this?
So yes and no. Again, we go back to the kits.
Yeah.
Different makes, manufacturers, you're not really going to see a performance decrease. Now, this is kind of something fun is... This has already been announced, so I'm not spoiling anything here. The 6.7 Cummins.
Mm-hmm.
Cummins actually redesigned the 6.7, and they have a 6.7 that is now solely designed to run on propane, a liquid propane setup.
Okay.
Which is going to be getting released soon. And that actually makes it more power and more torque than its diesel counterpart.
No kidding. Wow.
Yeah.
That's crazy. I never would have guessed that. That's wild.
But yeah, I have no problem running, you know, I kind of do what Scott shot and taught, you know, the 1-2 shift, you know,
okay.
When I get them on propane, I foot to the floor. I mean, not to abuse them, but if there's going to be an issue, it's going to be at load.
Okay. Gotcha. What would be an issue if you saw it there? Something like leaning out or with the delivery of the fuel, like what are the problems you run into?
Yeah, so I mean, unless we have some sort of design flaw in the part where in manufacturing something happened or an O-ring gets pinched in one of those reducers or even a vapor line. I've seen some installs where I fielded a call. They couldn't figure out why this thing was spiking and then just diving in pressure and it would stutter and not run on propane. And it ended up being one of the vapor lines was just when they ran it from the reducer to the injectors.
Mm-hmm.
That main feed just got pinched off a little bit. So it was just creating a restriction.
Okay. Okay. I suppose with the custom stuff install, it can definitely be an issue. What about the filters? You mentioned the filters earlier. Like how's that set up? Is it just in line? Where does it filter along the process? Like back by the tank or what?
So from the tank, we'll run a liquid line up into the engine bay. And on that liquid line, we'll actually have a liquid pre-filter.
Okay, that makes sense.
So you have a liquid filter that runs, and this is just on vapor setups. We don't, it'll change a little bit on a liquid setup. This is for a vapor setup.
Okay.
So you'll do a liquid pre-filter before the reducer, and then after the reducer, you'll have a vapor filter before it hits the injectors.
Gotcha.
And after the initial install, about 15,000 miles is kind of that first break-in period where we'll want to have those changed. And then after that, it's you could go 50, 60,000 miles. It really depends on driving and habits at that point. I've heard technicians have people in their fleet go 80,000 miles without doing filters without a problem.
Okay.
Propane's pretty pure. When we're running autogas propane, we call it HD5, so it's 95% purity. There's only 5% others.
Yeah, I wonder, can you see the difference in the oil of the engine? And I'm thinking along the lines of blow-by gases and, you know, the reason your oil gets dirty, and being that propane's much cleaner.
Oh, yeah. So we still recommend going with your OE recommendation. Obviously, me being in a shop, I don't recommend a 10,000 mile oil change.
Yeah, right. No, I'm right there with you. If you like your engine and you don't like spending money on it, change your oil sooner than what the manufacturer recommends.
I used to preach that. It's cheap insurance.
Yeah.
I got into that with Toyota because I'm a big Toyota guy. And before I was working on cars, if I just ran into Toyota and would do an oil change, I would make that argument with them. Why does my service light come on at 5,000 miles if we're changing the oil at 10?
Yeah, right. Well, the GMs where it's been for so long, it ends up, if you go to the light, you're going 8,000 miles in a lot of cases. And these motors, they can't handle it. it's rough enough for a 3.6 or a 2.4. If you do change it, like every 3,000, but I mean, that gives it the best chance at least to do that. You're going that full length in between. Good luck.
Yeah. I've seen timing chain and phaser issues and all kinds of stuff. And just the sludge buildup alone, you know, mm-hmm. I think a lot of the OEs are, they tell you to do that just to get you outside of warranty at that point.
Yep. Yeah. It's that planned obsolescence thing. I was having that conversation with somebody the other day of like, these things are meant to fall apart at 150,000 miles nowadays. Like, because somebody was asking me, like, what's a good vehicle I should buy? Like, what's a quality vehicle? And I'm just like, it's all crap.
Yeah. And I always just tell people, it depends on maintenance, too.
Yeah, like, yeah.
If you want to take care of your vehicle, it'll last a lot longer.
Yep.
But to loop back on your question, it is. The oil is drastically cleaner. We have less carbon. So
okay.
Chemical makeup of propane, C3H8, and then gasoline, which is obviously made of a bunch of different compounds. But as far as a chemical makeup standpoint, we're looking at C8H, what is it, 14 or something like that?
Okay.
So far less carbon. So your oil is going to stay cleaner a lot longer, but that doesn't mean that you should extend that oil change because obviously the heat is what's going to kill oil. So
sure. Yeah. Yeah. There's lots of good reasons to continue on it. I would be curious to see, like, if I had a vehicle and, you know, I'm running it X amount of time on propane, you go to do that oil change. Like if you're doing it yourself, like you look at the oil and say, oh, okay, well, how does it look? You know, I see any metal shiny things in there. How black is it? And I would be curious to see the difference between just a regular gas engine and something you're using propane on. Cause yeah, obviously it's going to burn a lot cleaner. So, I mean, maybe look at it that way as you might extend the life of your engine potentially doing it this way.
They do say that in these kits that with propane being cleaner burning and less carbon, especially if you're going to maintain it, you could get more longevity out of an engine. Some vehicles we convert with mileage on them already. And I've also converted brand new vehicles with 20, 30 miles on them. And the ones that I see that we do brand new, if they keep up on oil changes and are taking care of that basic maintenance, it is drastically cleaner every time you drop that oil.
Yeah, I'm thinking about the intake manifolds and the intake valves on these GDI vehicles now that, you know, for a number of years, we've been seeing the carbon buildup on the valves and then in the intake too. But mainly on the valves was an issue because we took away those injectors that were spraying on the top of the intake valves. And so now it's weird. It depends on the vehicle. Some vehicles don't seem susceptible to performance issues because of it, and others really are. You get that cold start, stumble, and misfire and stuff. I wonder if the propane would help to keep some of that buildup from happening.
So that's actually really interesting that you brought that up, because petrol is a wet fuel, mm-hmm. right? When we run gas or propane, it's a dry fuel. So I think I could get you some pictures after the show of comparison of propane versus gasoline on GDI, and it's cleaner as well. You'll see less carbon buildup.
Interesting. Well, just to have something going across that valve, you know, to stop that buildup, right? And I don't know the difference in, right, there's detergents and stuff that the liquid fuel when it's being sprayed on top of that intake valve is what you look at a port injected vehicle, and the tops of those valves are perfectly clean, right? There's nothing built right. on them. And then you go to a GDI vehicle and you're like, oh man, it's just a black, you know, gross thing on there.
Oh yeah.
And I wonder if the gas itself, propane, because it's a vapor form when it's going in through the intake valves, right?
Correct. Even on a liquid setup, we're doing the same thing as regular DI or PI injectors at that point. Is once it fires out of the injector, it's going to vaporize compared to a petrol system where it's going to atomize
sure.
that fuel.
Yep. Okay. We mentioned a little bit the compressed natural gas. Do you guys do stuff with that too, or how similar is that to all of this?
So that's... The kits that I work with specifically can do CNG compressed natural gas and LNG liquid natural gas.
Okay.
But however, I work for a propane company. So
gotcha.
Obviously, you know, we want to push the propane portion of it. Uh-huh. I mean, like I said, it is the third most used alternative fuel behind gasoline and diesel. So it is a good clean fuel source, and we get a little better BTU content over CNG. Not to say that there's anything wrong with it, but you also look at pressures on CNG. The lowest minimum pressure you're going to have is 2,600 PSI.
Oh, wow.
Which is kind of crazy to be dealing with.
Yeah, no kidding. That presents some safety concerns, I would imagine.
I would rather be near a propane tank if the... the valve was going to go off than a CNG
sure.
tank.
Yeah, I'll take 300 over a 26 for sure.
And yeah, I don't remember what CNG's temperature. I don't remember if it's colder than propane or not.
That's actually an interesting thought. What are the considerations or the concerns in the case of an accident with one of these systems, the pressurized gas system? Or how about, and sorry to interrupt you, how about after the accident, like jaws of life, what the firefighters need to be aware of, how they would even be aware of something like that?
So this is good that you bring this up too. I have to follow NFPA 58 standards when I install these kits. So National Fire Protection Act, I have to set the tanks in a certain way. They are stickered that they are running propane. Most of these are going to know where that shutoff is directly on the tank. We also have an electric solenoid as well as a manual one. So say for whatever reason you ran something over, and even though I tuck the liquid line away, it gets severed. That propane system is going to register that pressure drop, and it's going to think that that tank is empty the minute that line gets cut, and that electronic valve is going to close.
Gotcha. Okay.
So you will have a dump of liquid and vapor very briefly, but that valve, the electronic valve, will shut off and that line is dead in the water.
What if there is a battery disconnect?
So we do that. That kit only requires a power and a ground, and we plug into the power distribution box. So we won't lose calibration. It's very rare. That battery would have to be unplugged for a long time for calibration to wipe. I've seen it happen.
I'm just talking about like the electronic shutoff portion specifically, right? Like if you're in a front end collision and the battery cable's severed or something like that, is there a backup to that system to shut off the tank?
So if it loses power, that it's going to completely shut off everything.
All those valves
are going to close. Yeah, because while we have power, it's powering those valves. So the minute it loses power, gotcha. It's done. Everything shuts
closed.
Off.
Got it. Okay. And then on the like first responder side of things, you said there's stickers. Those are in a place like they're trained to look for that.
Correct. So NFPA 58 standard says that it has to be in a fixed portion of the vehicle on the back right panel. So if we have a service body on an F-Series pickup, it has to be in that lower right corner. It can't be on the bumper because the bumper is removable. It has to be a fixed portion of the body.
Got it.
Which, speaking of, we were talking about CNG earlier. I wanted to get my ASE for alternative fuels, but they only offer it for CNG.
Oh,
there
really?
Is no LNG or propane, yeah.
Okay. Well, ASE, let's get on that.
That's something I would like to see, since propane seems to be a little more popular than CNG. I would like an ASE cert for it. I did try and study and go for the CNG one just to have it, even though I'm doing propane. And there are some minor differences, and I think I missed by two questions.
Okay.
So I just haven't gone back and tried to do it. And then there's that variance between kits and hardware as well. So.
Oh, for sure. Yeah, and something like that, you'd really want to know what standards are they basing the test off of in order to answer the questions, because I'm sure there's a lot of variability because, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, there's not like a standardization of it, right?
Correct. So just like the automotive world, there's not a lot of intervention. Obviously, we have to meet EPA certs. They want us to do that.
Right.
And we have to follow NFPA guidelines, which says, you know, if you have a flat tire, your tank has to be 8 inches off the ground if it's under the vehicle, things like that. But there's no standardization as far as building the kits. That you need to run this component or that component, or, you know, that they can vary from manufacturer to manufacturer.
Okay.
I'm actually in the process of a lot of our fleets run Roush and ICOM stuff, and they've reached out to our company and said, hey, can you guys help us with this? And we said yes, even though we don't partner with them directly. I'm going to go through training with Roush and ICOM just so I can help the fleets that we have.
Well, that is very informative and very interesting. There's a lot of stuff that I knew absolutely nothing about. So thank you for sharing that. Is there any other points you wanted to touch on before we wrap it up?
I mean, not really. I mean, I could have gotten the history of autogas and some stuff like that, but I think we covered a lot of ground.
Okay. You give me your best Hank Hill impression if you want.
I can't even try to impersonate.
God damn it, Bobby. Yeah, I'm not very good.
Yeah, that's about the best I could do. I actually joked with my friend about doing that. I said, yeah, I'll talk to Sean. I'm sure we'll make some Hank Hill jokes in there along the way.
You should have just started with like the accents and then not like, what? This is normal. This is how I talk.
Should have practiced beforehand. Yeah, that would have been great.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh boy. Cool. Well, yeah. Thank you for spending the time tonight, Mike. I appreciate it.
Absolutely. I'm glad I could, you know, give back and be a part of the community. A lot of you guys that, you know, you in particular and the other guys I've listened to on the show, you're light years ahead of me. I just happen to work in alternative fuels. So
yeah, it's all just different specializations is what I've come to find. It's like you talk to just about anybody who's passionate in this industry and they've got a niche, they've got a thing that they're extremely knowledgeable about. And that's what it's all about, is getting to know more and more people and figure out, you know, with everybody combined, there's so much knowledge. It's absolutely crazy.
Yeah. And this company actually sent me to ATE here, which was my first formal training that I've ever been to.
Nice.
Which which was quite an experience. I got to meet John Thornton Scott Shotton, Keith Perkins.
Oh, yeah.
Eric Ziegler. So a lot of great guys.
Superstars and, there, yeah.
Yeah. I look forward to going to some more, and I really want to try to go to Vision next year. So.
Yep. Yeah. It's awesome because we have so many different opportunities and events to go to. And sometimes that's the tough part, is figuring out like which ones do I want to attend. So, I think the next big one is ASTE in September. I don't know if there's any other real big events before then. I'm pretty sure I'll be going to that. I haven't officially planned it, but yeah, lots of good training out there. So, all right, that's going to do it for today's episode. Thank you to Mike for joining me. Really interesting stuff. Again, just a whole nother side to things that you don't normally think of. So thank you to Mike, and thank you to everybody out there that listens to the show and all the feedback that I get. I do try to get back to everybody. It's not always in the most timely basis, but I do try to respond to everybody that shoots me an email. So if you don't get one right away, I'm not ignoring you. Just working through my normal amount of busy life, and then sometimes I forget to hop on the email and get back to people, but I will do my best, and I do appreciate the feedback. That's why I'm mentioning it. So thank you again, and with that out of the way, let's get out there, start fixing the world one car at a time.